Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The theme of our hour today is it's a dangerous world out there, and we're going to give you some advice, some tips, information on how to protect yourself. In the second half of the program, we'll respond to that Medicaid breach. The state's data systems were hacked, apparently by Eastern European hackers, loss of some Medicaid data, a lot of Medicaid data. And we're going to ask, how secure is our information out there in cyberspace? How can we protect ourselves? In the first half of the program, we're going to be talking about securities fraud, scams of all types, how to protect ourselves there. And we're joined in this part of the program by Keith Woodwell, Director of Utah Division of Securities. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
We appreciate you taking time to be with us. And joining us as well is Brent Baker, who's a shareholder and member of Clyde Snow's White Collar Crime and Independent Investigations Group. Mr. Baker, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
I notice, Mr. Woodwell, that our two subjects are joined up. There's Francine Gianni from the State Executive Director of Utah Department of Commerce is out with a fraud alert regarding this Medicaid data breach. She's reminding us that we should never give out our information over the phone or in an insecure place. It seems like anytime there's a high-profile problem, scam artists are sure to follow.
Yeah, you know, just as you pointed out in the intro, unfortunately, we do still live in a dangerous world, and there are no shortage of people out there who are willing to take advantage of us. But, you know, I think the good news in that is that, you know, as the message was pointing out from Francine Gianni, there are steps that we can take to help protect ourselves. And that's true whether we're talking about identity theft or investment fraud. There are a few key things we can do.
So remind us what the Division of Securities does.
Sure. Well, we're the state agency that's kind of the state equivalent to the Securities and Exchange Commission. We license and regulate all of the stockbrokers and investment advisors in the state. But the bulk of our time really is taking up investigating cases of investment fraud, which unfortunately occur far too often in the state. And our goal there is both to, you know, punish the perpetrators, but also to hopefully recover money that's been lost to investors.
And it's often known as securities fraud, right? Tell us what a security is.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the most hotly litigated topics in the law. And most of us recognize that maybe like stocks and bonds and things like that are securities. But really, it can take a variety of shapes and sizes. And it's any time when you're investing money with someone with the expectation of making a profit based on their efforts rather than anything that you're going to do yourself. So any kind of passive investment really is best considered a security.
And Utah at one time was known as the fraud capital, scam capital of the nation. Do we still hold that dubious honor?
You know, Tom, that's a question I get asked a lot. And I used to say, well, you know, no, I don't think it's really any worse here than it is in other states. And unfortunately, over the last year or so, I've been proven wrong on that. A couple of different studies, one by a business intelligence firm that looked at Ponzi schemes all over the country, and in most different measures, depending on how you rack and stack the data, Utah came out in the top five. And the FBI recently put out its top five hotspots for white-collar crime, you know, mostly investment fraud, but other types of white-collar crime, too. And unfortunately, Utah made the top five list there as well. So it is still a problem in our state.
Why Utah? Why are we at the top there?
You know, I think that a lot of it is just the con artists out there take advantage of what is best about our society. And one of the best things in our society here in Utah is that we tend to be trusting. We're a close-knit community. We know who our neighbors are, which, you know, if you've lived in different parts of the country, I know certainly when I lived in California, for example, I didn't know who most of my neighbors were. You know, I see them on the street once in a while, but I couldn't have told you their names. Whereas here, you tend to move in, and you know, next thing you know, there's a plate of cookies being delivered to your door by your neighbors, and they're asking if they can help move some boxes for you. So we know who our neighbors are, and we trust them, But unfortunately, those are the types of characteristics that con men are trying to take advantage of.
Let's bring in Brent Baker from Clyde Snow and their White Collar Crime and Independent Investigations Group. What is that group?
Well, it's a group that is comprised of former SEC, former regulators, former Justice Department lawyers that really help people who get their shirt tail caught in the government machinery. But you know, one of the reasons that I've been such an advocate for educating Utahns and, frankly, Americans. I spent 12 years at the SEC prosecuting this type of fraud, similar to what Keith is doing right now. And I really see that, as he mentioned, it's a problem here in Utah. We are far too trusting.
Hmm. What are some of the most common cons, scams?
Well, again, I hate to keep referring to Keith, but Keith, I heard him on the radio one time a year or two ago, and the one line that he gave that was a classic is, con men read the newspaper. And so what they'll do is they'll size you up and they will read the newspaper. They know what you're reading and seeing on the news, and they'll tailor their particular investment scam to the current press.
Hmm.
In fact, I've even known these con men, and con, of course, is a derivative of confidence, and that's because they instill confidence. I've seen them describe a situation where they are walking up to your house and sizing you up as they approach your door, or as they approach you in a religious setting, or in a professional setting. They watch for, you know, signs of you know, trikes, bicycles in the driveway. They look for certain diplomas on the wall. So you just need to be aware that you are giving off signs and they're being used.
So not surprising that we're seeing this story about warnings of protecting ourselves, but potential scams related to this Medicaid information breach. I guess the con men are going to be reading the papers. They're going to be devising scams based on that.
No doubt that they will. And, you know, unfortunately, that's the world we live in today, where personal information about you, whether that's your Social Security number or other data, has a lot of value. Because if they can put together enough information, they can open up accounts in your name, whether those are credit accounts or get a loan in your name, and it'll be your credit that suffers until you can get that cleaned up. You know, so it's an ongoing concern that's out there.
Let's hear a spot. This is a television spot taken from the Utah Division of Security's site. It's your red flag campaign, and you're hearing a version of those spots on Utah Public Radio as well. Let's hear one of these and talk about it.
I should have seen them. They were right there in front of me. I was in pretty good shape for retirement, but then the market took a dive. He told me the returns would be amazing and fast. He pressured me, so I gave him our life savings. Now it's all gone. Now we're in a bigger financial hole than ever. I should have seen them. Red flags, they were everywhere.
To learn the red flags of investing, call or log on to the Utah Division of Securities. Check before you invest.
So that's a red flag spot, and if you see the television version of this, is a person standing in front of a bunch of red flags. Mr. Woodwell, and I'll also ask this to Mr. Baker as well, what are some of the red flags?
Yeah, Tom, the message we're trying to get out there is there are certain elements that any of us can recognize that probably indicate that this could be a scam. And so you heard some of those in that spot. You know, if they're telling you that the returns are going to be fantastic, but there's little or no time to get in, you know, you need to get in a hurry. These are all warning signs. You know, if there's one thing, I think, one tool that people can use and remember, it's that when you invest in anything, and I do mean that anything, and there are no exceptions, I don't think, to this rule, return and reward, or risk and reward, always go together. So if somebody's promising you very high rewards, that you're going to get a great interest rate on this, we're going to double your money in 6 months, whatever it is, and then at the same time they're telling you there's little or no risk involved in the investment, you don't need to know anything else. That's a lie. There is no investment where you get great returns with little or no risk. You can try to minimize risk in your investing, but that means you put your money, you know, in a savings account at the bank, and we all know what we're getting on that. You know, it's less than 1%. Or you can chase bigger rewards like in the stock market, but you are taking on more risk. So the con men try to break that relationship, and that's one of the biggest red flags out there. If somebody tells you you get great rewards, little or no risk, you don't need to hear anything else.
Mr. Baker, what are some of the other red flags that you've seen?
Sure. Some of them that are, I think, common to all scams that I have seen in my many years of doing this are this notion of complexity. If you can't understand the investment, or if they tell you that it's shrouded in some level of secrecy, then that's a very big red flag. Keith mentioned this notion of immediacy. If they tell you that it's open today or this week only and you have to get in, a huge red flag. Also this notion of exclusivity, something that was formerly only available to the very rich but now is available to us common people. Another red flag. And finally, the one that we deal with all the time and one that Keith and I have teamed up to kind of help people understand how to avoid, and that is this notion of affinity. So if someone approaches you and tries to get you to let your guard down or to not use your common sense simply because they belong to a group you belong to, some trust-based group, and I'm talking about either a religious group, it can be, you know, a group like even the hearing impaired community, I've seen them targeted. So it doesn't matter if it's religion or not. If they say, you know, we belong to the same group, and therefore you should trust me, that's a huge red flag.
Mm-hmm. And we do want to trust, don't we? We're very trusting people. I guess when it comes to money, you need to be very, very careful.
Well, you know, I think we still can trust, but, you know, as Ronald Reagan used to say, you got to trust but verify. So it's okay to have that confidence and think, well, you know, this person shares some values with me and I think I can trust them. But that's no substitute for doing your own checking. You know, and Brent brings up an excellent point there. If somebody is making the pitch and it's based on the fact that, hey, you know, you can trust me because I'm like you. We go to church together or we're in the same club or organization, that's fine and that may interest you, but it's no substitute for going out and actually doing your homework. And there are a lot of different ways you can do that. It's amazing what you'd find just on a Google search. You know, if somebody's got bankruptcy proceedings or they have some criminal record even, previous lawsuits, you might find that in a Google search. And if you want to go a step further, you can call our office or go to a reputable securities attorney in town like Brent and ask them to look over the offer and say, hey, does this make sense? Does this seem real? Get a second opinion from someone who's not involved in the deal.
If you just joined us in this part of the program, we're talking about securities fraud, talking about the red flag campaign that the Utah Division of Securities has going. We heard one of those spots, and you're hearing those on Utah Public Radio. Keith Woodwell, director of the division, is with us, and Brent Baker specializes in this area and is with Clyde Snow, attorney. Brent Baker is with us as well, and you're welcome to join the conversation with your question or comment. 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. And by the way, we do have a pair of tickets to Valley Dance Ensemble, their performance either Friday or Saturday night in the Ellen Eccles Theater in Logan. So if you're in the Logan area, you're going to be on the weekend. A pair of tickets when you call and come on with a question or comment. 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. We'll continue a general theme of protecting ourselves in the second half today, talking about how we can protect our information out in cyberspace, a conversation occasioned by that Medicaid breach we've all been hearing about. Once again, the number 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Brent Baker, you, I know, son, your biography here, and I have a vague memory of this. You apparently are founder of something called Fraud College?
Yes. I know the name sounds a little funny, but that's actually a name that was coined by the SEC in response to all the negative media attention for missing these massive Ponzi schemes that swept across our country and at just the wrong time. The chairman of the SEC said that she was going to send her staff off to fraud college. And I got to thinking that we here in America, and frankly in Utah specifically, we believe in personal responsibility. We believe in being our own first line of defense. And so I worked with Keith and Francine, and we put together a grassroots educational conference that law enforcement and government officials participated in, including Governor Herbert for the last 2 years, to help people understand and to, as Keith mentioned, think or check before they invest. Keith won't tell you about the wonderful division website because that's what he does all day long, but I've got to tell you, even the types of due diligence that he's mentioning, where he talked about a Google search, they have a very elegant and new website at the securities division that you can go to and search many of these things. You can search many public databases. You can find out a lot before you invest. And unlike many other government agencies, these guys will take your call. Those are things you can do.
Yes, the site is securities.utah.gov. I just Googled Utah Division of Securities, but it's securities.utah.gov. A lot of great stuff there. Let's hear another of these red flag television spots, and then I want to ask a question about the demographics. Who are most likely to get scammed? Let's hear another one of these.
I should have seen them. They were right in front of me. We met in church. One day he told me he had inside information on a breakthrough technology, and I should invest in it right away. Well, it was my life savings. Now it's gone. Oh, I should have seen them. Red flags, they were everywhere.
To learn the red flags of investing, call or log on to the Utah Division of Securities. Check before you invest.
So there's another one of those television spots. You're hearing the radio version on Utah Public Radio. Am I right in assuming you sometimes, I don't know, I get this stereotype from the news reports, elderly, more vulnerable?
Yeah, Tom, I think that is somewhat accurate, and you can tell even from, you know, hearing that voice, this is an elderly woman who's been taken advantage of. And if we are overrepresented in any certain category of the community for being victims of investment fraud, it is probably the elderly. And rightly or wrongly, the scam artists out there target seniors because they feel, well, that's where the money is. These are the people that have had a chance to build up their savings, build up their retirement portfolio over time. So that's where the money is, and that's who they go after. But that doesn't mean that anyone in our society is immune from this type of pitch. We see all different types of people who are victims of securities fraud. You know, the interesting thing in a couple of the academic studies that have been done is you might assume that, well, it's people who are pretty unsophisticated and uneducated that are mostly going to be taking advantage of here, and that's actually not the case. The typical victim in an investment scam tends to be someone who is well-educated, somewhat affluent. So we have a lot of lawyers, doctors who end up as victims here. And I think part of that is, frankly, we end up in a good scam. We end up conning ourselves. You know, the con man's not going to be super aggressive necessarily with really high-pressure tactics. The good ones will get you to think that it was your idea to invest. Mm-hmm. they just dangle out there about, you know, how great they're doing. You see that they're driving a new car and living in a really nice house. And maybe you go ask them, you know, yeah, what are you doing? You know, how are you making all this money? And then when they dangle it out there, they kind of act like, well, as a favor to you, they're going to let you in on this deal. And that's how some of the more wealthy, more sophisticated people get sucked into these scams. And it happens over and over and over.
Yeah, it does seem to happen all the time. I guess that's the reason for this, the campaign like yours. And I guess a lot of people are taken who think, oh, I can see it coming.
Yeah, and maybe part of that is if you are pretty savvy when it comes to financial matters, you feel like, well, you know, I can protect my own interests. I know which way is up when it comes to this kind of world, and I can evaluate a deal on my own and have a pretty good sense of what may be legitimate and what isn't. And so they skip that so important step of checking before they invest. You know, going to our website, like I thank Brent for, you know, giving us that nice plug. But we do have a lot of materials there where you can search a lot of databases and find out if there are some red flags that you need to know about. And unfortunately, most people skip that step.
Brent Baker, the sums that you read about and hear about, even in these spots, you know, in your entire life savings, it's just heartbreaking. Is that usual? Like, once you're in, you're all in, and you're out a lot of money.
Yeah, oftentimes these investments will tell you falsely that there is a minimum that you have to invest to participate. But the sums are staggering, and in this economy, though, that money should be going into legitimate investments. That should be going into, you know, the next Apple. And there are things you can do to protect yourself. You know, when you played that last radio spot, it was interesting because I've seen a case that the SEC prosecuted against an individual who sent out a mass email claiming to have an inside tip, the exact language that you just heard. That email went out, and within one day, just by sending out a mass email, it raised $1 million by selling that fake inside tip. Mm. So, you know, I love the phrase that I've heard before, that I've never met a con man I didn't like in all these years. Mm. These people are very skilled at what they do. And one other thing when we're talking about dollars here that I think is kind of interesting to let people know the size of this problem. I believe it was in 2010 when Keith worked with the FBI and the SEC and others who help protect our community from fraud here. They came up with a figure of $1.5 billion in reported fraud during that year period. And I just for fun went to the Utah Ski and Snowboarding Association's website to see how much revenue we brought in from, you know, our best known industry here in Utah, our wonderful mountains. And during that same time period when people were losing $1.4 billion to fraud, the ski industry was bringing in $1.2 billion. Mm. So we essentially allow our ski industry to be netted out by fraud.
Hmm. We're running out of time here. I just want to maybe get each of you to give me a closing statement, appeal to people how to protect themselves. Before I do that, let me have Mr. Woodwell address another question. What if you have been taken in a scam? What can you do?
Well, report it is the first thing to do, because so much of this goes unreported, because maybe it was somebody that you do have a close relationship with who took advantage of you. And I fear that far too much of this goes unreported. If it is reported, I don't want to give a false hope that, well, you're for sure going to get 100% of your money back, but we do recover some. Now, usually that's only maybe 10 cents on the dollar, but it also serves as a deterrent so that we can stop those people from taking advantage of others in the future. And, you know, just as a parting shot, I guess I would say, yes, this is a serious problem in Utah, and the cost is terrible. People often lose their life savings. But the point I want people to remember is it's preventable. There are steps that you can take to prevent this. Do your homework. There's no substitute for that. You've got to go out and do some checking before you put your money into an investment. Make sure you get a second opinion. Do the research so that then you feel confident when you make your choice.
And Mr. Baker, we'll give you the last word, just your appeal. And there are a lot of ways that that people get conned, aren't there? The promissory notes and bogus stocks and Ponzi schemes. How can we keep ourselves safe?
Well, I hate to keep using the same phrase here, but you really need to think before you invest. You need to check before you invest. And Keith alluded to this earlier, but we don't want to let this problem erode what's best about our community, and that is that we are open and we are kind and we are tolerant. But don't be a victim. This is something that you can prevent by simply checking before you invest.
Very good. We'll leave it there. We'll continue this note of protecting ourselves. We'll talk about how we can protect our information out there in cyberspace, a conversation occasioned by this breach of information, Medicaid information from state websites. On this part of the program, we've been talking with Keith Woodwell, Director of Utah Division of Securities. By the way, the site is securities.utah.gov. A lot of great information there, including licensing, and check out licensing of people that approach you. Keith Woodwell, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Brent Baker, who is with Clyde Snow's White Collar Crime and Independent Investigations Group. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Coming up, as I mentioned, how safe is our information out in cyberspace? We'll ask that question that follows this commentary.
Utah writer Gina Wickwar.
This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Girl Scouts of the USA. I and my daughter were Girl Scouts, and every once in a while we reminisce about our days as Brownies and later as badge-earning Scouts. I became a Brownie when I was 8 and living in California, but almost immediately my father, an Air Force officer, was transferred to the Panama Canal Zone, so we left the West Coast for the tropics. There I quickly joined the Air Base's Brownie Troop and began my scouting career. What I loved most about being a Brownie, other than the camaraderie of my troop, was being able to wear my Brownie uniform to school once a month on the day of our after-school meeting held in a large rec room on the base. My mother washed and starched and ironed my little brown dress that I wore, along with my Brownie socks, Brownie belt, and my little Brownie beanie. The uniform meant we Brownies in class could salute the flag, right hand, middle three fingers, when we said the pledge rather than cover our hearts. That was immensely satisfying, and I know I felt especially important on those days. As Brownies, we mostly learned crafts. I still have about a half dozen faux leather lanyards made to secure my roller skate keys. Painted and drew, sang songs for around the campfire, learned to properly raise, lower, and fold Old Glory, and memorized the Girl Scout promise, law, motto, and slogan. When I became 10, I flew up, today called bridging, and became an intermediate Girl Scout. My uniform became distinctly more sophisticated. My brown dress and beanie gave way to a green dress, a green beret, and a green scarf, and I gained a sash for those highly anticipated badges. I also began to participate in some actual scouting activities. Because we were in Panama, there wasn't a lot of camping in the wild. Apparently, they hadn't invented badges for eluding boa constrictors, cougars, tarantulas, and wild pigs. More's the pity. So our camping experiences took place in a more civilized environ, large, low, screened buildings on the outskirts of either Panama City or Balboa, where we joined other Panamanian troops. We sang around the campfire, roasted marshmallows and s'mores, tramped along jungle paths, which had all been carefully cleared, to catalog the flora and the occasional large insect colony, rode horses, and performed various service projects, such as boxing canned goods to give to the poor. And we launched into the serious work of earning badges. By the time I left my troop in the Canal Zone to return to the U.S., my sash was already filling up with badges, all carefully sewn on by my grandmother. I arrived in Yuma, Arizona, proud to resume scouting, badge earning, and to begin junior high. My sophomore year, we transferred to Tampa, Florida, where I continued scouting, now as a senior 15-year-old scout. I earned badges in such subjects as tree identification, sewing, cooking, homemaking, which was how to iron and how to set the table, etc., citizenry, good grooming, etc., etc. And, of course, there was the yearly Girl Scout cookie drive that I love. It was actually a great learning experience for a young woman to walk up to a house, ring the bell, and try to sell your wares. A cold call, as they say in sales lingo. But it gave us confidence and independence. My daughter, too, loved her years as a Girl Scout. Alas, she now has two boys, but my two sons have daughters, so our scouting tradition continues. My granddaughters are, like many of the young women I know here in Cache Valley, trying to do, quote, a good deed daily. Happy 100 years, Girl Scouts. This is Gina Wickwar.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Handel's Messiah with the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, directed by Craig Jessup, this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Kent Concert Hall. Information and tickets are at AmericanFestivalChorus.org.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We continue the theme of self-protection. And there are dangers out there. We talked in the first half of the program about securities fraud. There's another danger we all became more acutely aware of. At least it got back on our radar screens with this data breach at the government server, apparently. And Governor Herbert has called for a security audit of the state's data systems following that loss by hacking of Medicaid data. And so in this half of the program, we're going to talk with Jonathan Choate from SD7 Technology Group and with Wayne Varga, who is with K3DES. He's former head of network security for the Salt Lake City Olympics. We'll ask them how secure is our information out there and what can we do to protect ourselves. So Jonathan Choate, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you joining us. And Wayne Varga, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Let me start with you, Jonathan. Something like this hits, I guess you live in this world all the time of security, but what do you think when something like this hits?
It is. I mean, it's unfortunate. It's fairly common. I mean, they're a big event when it happens, but we see them in the news regularly, whether it's a private company or whether it's government servers. You know, there's a lot of standards out there to try to get particularly this very sensitive data, which is the medical data is generally considered the most sensitive, and then, payment data is the second most. Those things, there's a lot of security that's supposed to be implemented for it. But unfortunately, people are human and they make mistakes. In this particular instance, it seemed like they followed the protocol, but somebody just messed up. They forgot to change a default password. They forgot to do something. And the hole in the security was found by those with unscrupulous intentions. Mm-hmm. And that's an unfortunate fact of living in a connected world, mm-hmm. living where we have the great benefits that come from it, but along with it come new and sometimes difficult to understand and difficult to protect ourselves from problems.
Wayne Varga, I guess we're all wondering how safe is our information? We live more and more even beyond our own computers. Our information's out there on a government server. We're in the cloud. How secure are we?
Well, the sad part is we're not as secure as we think we are. And this type of a news report about a breach in the security of the state system only makes us think we're less secure. I mean, the sad reality is that there are so many systems out online with dozens, if not hundreds, of different companies, all of which have portions or pieces of your personal information. And a breach in one of them can literally compromise your entire life.
Yeah, that's true. A vital piece of information gets out, and then you're prone to identity theft or you lose a bunch of money. So you were saying that when the word gets out like this, a highly publicized case, that makes us less secure?
Well, it makes us less secure only from the sense of it increases the awareness in our own mind, and we become more aware of how really insecure we really are.
If you'd like to join this conversation, we're talking about cybersecurity. How safe is our information out there? The number is 1-800-826-1495. We do still have a pair of tickets to a performance by the Valley Dance Ensemble, and this is for either Friday or Saturday night, this coming weekend, in Logan at the Ellen Eccles Theater. If you'd like to see that performance, it's called Amplify. From the Valley Dance Ensemble, just call in with your question or comment on the program here at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. I want to ask you, Wayne Varga, you've been in this field for a while. In fact, you were, interestingly, former head of network security for Salt Lake City Olympics. How has the threat changed? What are the problems still the same?
Well, the problems essentially are the same, but the methods used to break into systems have become more readily accessible. I mean, it's easy for somebody to just start into this, do a quick web search, and within a few minutes download automated tools which allow them to essentially break into any system they want from the comfort of the beach or their basement or wherever they want to be.
Wherever in Eastern Europe they're located,
yeah.
Or China.
Right. So this is anywhere in the world, and very hard to find and prosecute these people.
Yeah, especially if they're in different countries. And we've found through many recent publicized breaches that a breach in one country may be perpetrated by someone in another country, and they're beyond the reach of law enforcement. And quite often, those people won't do anything with the information they sell. I mean, they'll capture it, and then they'll sell it on the black market to somebody in a third country. So quite often, it's really difficult to get back to the people who are actually causing the breach.
Hmm. And many of them are also associated with organized crime, large organized crime. Hmm. Again, particularly Eastern Europe, the mafia groups, it is a huge source of income for them because the laws the laws allow them to get away with this, control of weak governments that don't. They don't protect people from that, and no extradition treaties and things of that nature make it so that they can have safe bases of operation. And we're connected to them, and they're just like they're connected to us. So we wish we had the security of the United States, but at the same time, we get the benefits of it being a free system. Mm. And it's a trade-off every time.
Right. I was going to ask you. Let me ask this of Jonathan Choate. You hear something like this massive. A big data breach of the government, and then you remember again how vulnerable we all are, and you might be tempted to just get off the grid. I don't know if that's even possible in today's world.
Well, the problem is you can get yourself off the grid, and you can do everything to protect yourself, which you should do. And I think before the end of the hour, we want to make sure we cover some of the simple things that people at home, and particularly in businesses that handle sensitive data, you can be as stupid as you want with your own data, but, please be safe with somebody else's that's been put in your trust. Mm-hmm. But, there are things you can do to protect yourself. But again, we are, even if you decide today to go live in the mountains and, never work on a computer again, a lot of your information still exists out there. It's already there, and you can't get rid of it. There's no possible way to do it. So it's all about managing and mitigating the potential problems rather than you can't get away from it. I suppose if you're born today with no social security number and you never interact, you're safe.
Right.
Other than that, there's data out there on you.
Which doesn't describe most of us. If you just joined us, we're talking about cybersecurity, how to keep our information safe. And we're talking with Jonathan Choate from SD7 Technology Group and with Wayne Varga from K3DES. He's also involved in eCenturion. Interesting, Mr. Varga, I was on the eCenturion site. We're seeing some tips. Let's start there. Let's follow up on what Jonathan was saying. Starting with you, what can I do to keep my information safe?
Well, the biggest thing you should do to keep your information safe is be constantly aware and be skeptical of who you give your information to. Beware of things you get in your inbox, your email, asking for information. No reputable company will ever ask you to disclose personal information in a email or over the phone if they contact you. They will always ask you to call them to a known number or ask you to fill out a form and do it in the proper channel. So always be skeptical. That's the big thing. And the second big thing that a lot of people forget about is you should always use different passwords in every site that you use. The risk there is that if somebody breaches one company's database, and get your username and password, then they can leverage that and access everything else that you go to. That's especially troublesome, for example, if you use the same password for your email as well as your online banking. Get access to your email and then go into your bank account and transfer money wherever they want.
And I think email is actually one of people don't think of, because if you go back and you look at the history in your email, pick if they have an online type of email like Gmail or Yahoo, which most of us have, you go back and do a search in there and you're going to find that all of those different the bank accounts that you signed up for, you know, your online banking, your credit card accounts, your all of those things that you have separate usernames and passwords for, all the confirmations sit there in your email. Mm-hmm. And your username is listed there and maybe the original password. So if your password is the same, once your email is compromised, all of that information for them to know where to go target generally sits in that email account. So it's very important you have, A, yes, a secure password and a separate one for your email account than anything else.
And delete those confirmation
emails? Not necessarily.
Okay.
I keep them because I always forget. That's the thing. I go back and I have to look and, wait, now what was my account for this one? So you don't necessarily have to delete them. It would be the best if you have a perfect memory. I don't. But try to make sure that you isolate and compartmentalize these things. So, you know, think of it like a ship. They have these watertight sections. You know, if you have a breach in one area, you got to make sure the whole ship doesn't go down just because you had one hole.
Mm-hmm. So different passwords for everything.
Yeah. Different passwords don't always necessarily use the same username. Change them on occasion, particularly if you feel like something weird happened. I answered an email and I just realized I shouldn't have. You know, something came up, it looked like my bank, and I just did it. And then I realized after, well, maybe that wasn't real. Mm-hmm. So maybe you immediately go and you change certain passwords. You react to those situations that come up and be proactive. Don't wait till after you've been hacked. If you think something's occurred, cancel that credit card you just entered on a site that doesn't look scrupulous. Mm-hmm. Change your PIN. Things of that type of nature. And maybe they did get some information, but you can prevent them from being able to do anything useful with it. Mm-hmm. Well, useful to them, not to us.
Wynn Vargut, I get especially nervous when I do my online banking. It's on the one hand, very, very convenient. And I guess we're online no matter whether we want to or not, if I use my debit card, for example. Those encrypted sites, am I okay there?
Well, you're okay only to the extent that the company behind the site is trustworthy. And the encrypted sites that use SSL security to encrypt data in transit really only protects the data while it's being sent from your computer to their servers. And really, there have been very few, if any, attacks against that part. The real threat is against the servers run by the bank. So that's where you have to be concerned. And I'm not suggesting that any one bank is more secure than the other. Just saying that that's where the attacks have been historically is against the institution itself.
So in some respect, we just have to trust the institutions we're doing business with, right? The information sitting there on their server, we have to trust that they're doing their due diligence.
Yeah, and even if you don't have an online banking account, I mean, your information still sits on the servers run by that bank. But the real risk of online banking is someone else getting a hold of your username and password, logging in as you, and then using the online bill pay system to send someone a check, maybe themselves.
Hmm. What are some other things we can do to protect ourselves, Jonathan?
Well, simple things. Again, most of hacking is not necessarily what you see on movies. It's not necessarily somebody in a dark room, hacking a system. That absolutely occurs, but not necessarily on your computer. Most of the hacking that occurs to the individual that they can stop is actually social engineering. It's a targeting the person rather than their computer. It's calling up and pretending to be somebody. It's calling an office and pretending to be from the phone company. And, oh, I need to get this information from your business because I'm with Comcast or I'm with Quest or I'm with whoever your provider happens to be. So, Wayne was absolutely correct in saying it. Being skeptical is if you have an IT professional and one of these things comes in, you may think you're annoying them, but you're absolutely 100% to give them a call, send them an email saying, I got this. Should I be worried? Is this something that's bad? It's the human reactions that are generally the failure in the system rather than the systems themselves or it's the human who failed to properly put a firewall or didn't have a password. Another thing would be theft of laptops, theft of phones. You know, if you don't have anything on your phone that allows you to wipe it remotely, or your laptop doesn't even have a password on it, truthfully, not that that's going to do that much, but it'll at least slow them down. Somebody sits down, you've got your password saved in your web browser to get you to connect to your email or to get you to connect to a number of sites. If you just thought about it for a minute, and if somebody stole that laptop, what information is saved on there that would allow them to directly go in and access certain things without ever having to know what your other passwords were? I mean, at least put a simple password on your machines. I mean, we have to balance security with productivity, mm-hmm. but we have to at least think about the security. We can't just right. abandon it.
And a lot of us, I guess we get busy, we don't think about the security. Is that what you find, Wayne Varga? A lot of people don't really think about that side of it.
Well, yeah, most people don't think about security. They don't think they're vulnerable until it happens to them or someone that they know. But I can tell you absolutely that security weaknesses and vulnerabilities exist everywhere. And I've been hired many times as a consultant and as a white hat hacker to go in and attack systems just to see what can be done. And I have never found a single system in my entire years of doing this that was not vulnerable in some way. There's always a way to get in.
Hmm. What about me at home? Should I put up software, firewall? What should I do to protect my personal computer?
Well, the biggest single thing that you should do to protect yourself is make sure that you have a good antivirus program and that you keep it updated. And make sure that that program protects not just against viruses, which is one particular type of bad software, but also protects against phishing sites and reputation attacks and other types of things. And that's the biggest single thing. I can't tell you how many individual systems I've looked at that, yeah, they had an antivirus program, but it came with a computer when they bought it 3 years ago and it's never been updated since.
Yeah, and it was a 90-day free trial.
Mm. Right, right. If you just joined us, we're talking about security out there in cyberspace, what we can do to protect ourselves. Governor Herbert has called for a security audit. One recent example, the state's data systems following the hacking of a Medicaid database on a server for the government. And we're talking in this part of the program with Wayne Varga from K3DES and with Jonathan Choate from SD7 Technology Group. You're welcome to join the conversation. And we still have a pair of tickets to the Valley Dance Ensemble's performance of Amplify. Some great dancing that's in the Ellen Eccles Theater in Logan. A pair of tickets for either Friday night or Saturday night with your call to the program. 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. Wayne Varga, I was reading on eCenturion, one of the groups you're involved with. This goes to Jonathan's point that people target the person, I guess, and not the not so much the technology. But that site said most security breaches, talking about businesses, come from trusted network administrators, and that the average cost of an insider attack is $2.7 million, 50 times more than the outside attack. So I guess you have to be very careful with the people you hire and the inside part of the operation.
Well, yes, and that's the sad part. I mean, we mentioned before that there's so much of your personal information stored on a system. And the people who run or administer that system have literally all access to everything on that system. They have to in order to get their yeah. job done.
Wayne and I personally experienced that. We are the administrators of multiple systems. There's a lot of information there. And you have to ensure that the people you are hiring to do these things are not only experienced and capable, but trustworthy. Obviously, nobody's perfect. I mean, we're not going to be able to know 100% for sure, but it's an important factor because there is an extreme amount of trust that's placed upon a system administrator, a network administrator, for the things that they could do. 99.9999% of the time, they don't do it. But there's a lot of chances, so it's very important.
Are there safeguards there? Is there licensure required? Is this just a matter of we need to trust companies to hire trustworthy people?
Well, there are certifications, but those don't necessarily mean that the person who has them is trustworthy. So the biggest recommendation is to perform background checks on all of the people that you hire individually. If you're hiring a company to manage it for you, make sure you get references and talk to other people who've dealt with them.
Wayne, I understand from Jonathan, you do PCI auditing. This is something that the university here we've become very familiar with. They've adopted PCI. Tell us what that is.
Well, PCI stands for Payment Card Industry, and it's really an association of all the major card brands, and they've banded together to issue some standards that govern how you handle credit card data. And any company that stores, processes, or transmits card data has to comply with that. So that's every merchant, it's every processor, it's every bank. And in my business, I've been dealing with dozens, not hundreds, of companies all across the world, helping them to make sure that they protect that card data that they have access to.
And what are some of the what are some of the rules?
Well, some of the rules, most of them are simple, and it includes things like making sure you do a background check of all of the people that you hire, but it also includes things like changing default passwords in systems, making sure antivirus programs are kept up to date, you have a firewall and intrusion detection systems. It also requires annual penetration tests, meaning hire someone to break in and see if it can be done. So it's actually the most comprehensive of all of the security standards in wide use in the industry.
And it is it's an industry standard that's been developed. It's not a mandated standard per se by government. In an instance like this where the technology is changing so rapidly, they are a poor body to make a decision as to what is decided, you know, what is secure and what is not. It is in the industry's best interest to regulate themselves to not be hacked. I mean, it costs them millions of dollars when this happens. So they have come up with what is a comprehensive and what is, so far at least, the best way to secure the data. And I always find that the funniest is that there's also significant physical security required for PCI compliance, because all of the network security in the world doesn't really help if somebody gets their hands physically on the machine.
Let's go to, we do have a couple of callers stacked up. We have 2 minutes left in the program. Let's try to be very quick. Rebecca in Smithfield, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I really am not knowledgeable about computers, but I understand that there is a difference between like Mac computers compared to just your normal computer. I don't know the difference, but are they more secure?
Thanks, Rebecca. Let's have a very quick answer.
Real quick on that one. In some ways, yes. The biggest reason that Macs are more secure is only because the target is smaller. If you're going to spend your time writing a piece of software to attack somebody, you're going to go for the widest target. Just recently, there have been several well-known attacks on Macintosh systems. So just because you have a Mac doesn't mean you're secure. You still need to get antivirus. You still need to have passwords. All the same rules apply.
And let's see if we can quickly fit in Lydia in Richmond. Go ahead with your question. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I think it's more of a comment. Yesterday, I had to call Amazon and discovered that they outsource to other countries. And the agent I had on the line was from Jamaica. And, you know, it's times like that that makes me nervous because, right at that moment, I realized that my information is in some other country. And so I'm just wondering how secure is that? I mean,
thanks, Lydia. We'll have to leave it there.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. 20 seconds, Jonathan.
Okay. The companies do their very best. Again, it's in their best interest to not let if you get hacked from Amazon, they lose business. So they do everything they can to try to stop it. But the reality is, the companies put in place safeguards. The person you're talking to on the phone only has a limited amount of information, but yet there is information there, which is why it's about social engineering. You don't give out that sensitive information to people on the phone. You just don't do it, whether they're legitimate or not. That's the most important thing right there.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks for the information. We've been talking with Wayne Varga from K3DES. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with Jonathan Choate from SD7 Technology Group. Thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.